that if one accepts that the economy is a living system, the rest becomes a self-evident truth. If one accepts that, and let's, for the purpose of our conversation, accept that we should think about the economy as a living system and the implications of that, the premise that follows that immediately is that we know a lot about how living systems actually work, because we have, you know, billions of years of history to study. And so there is a science that understands living systems. And that's why my focus was on sort of trying to distill first principles, design principles, not ethical beliefs, not ideology, not left, not right, but descriptive. This is how the thing works. And that's what regeneration actually means. It's the process that explains how life works. So, you know, we're now in what we call the polycrisis, which, you know, people have anticipated for at least a half a century, because they understand that, you know, complexity eventually, if you don't manage complexity intelligently, you trigger collapse. And so if this is meant to be a living system, then we need to understand how living systems remain living systems and not dead or collapsed systems. And that then gets to a diagnosis of all the things that we do in our current economic behavior and business behavior that are in conflict with how living systems work, one of which is the issue you just raised. But the key point is that we need to step back and say, well, we need to learn and understand how living systems work. So I would argue no one in a position of policy or business leadership has any right to be in those positions if they don't understand basic ecology. With that as context, Fay, why don't you respond about the exchange question?
I love the shift from extraction to exchange at every level. I'll just speak to the first principle of the eight principles that John distilled, in right relationship. And the right relationship, right from what Jude Caravan calls the big breath, we've heard of it as the big bang, all of it had to exist in right relationship for it to even come into being. And that right relationship is about an exchange. In the relationship, there is exchange and not extraction. And I'm just going to read this piece from that section of the book, because it's such a beautiful image, and I think the images help us experience what this exchange is about. Fungi play a crucial role in forests. Trees are connected to other trees via vast mycorrhizal networks made up of tiny threads called mycelium. Mushrooms are the fruit of the mycorrhizal network, a fungus that enables trees in a healthy forest to share water and nutrients with one another for the health of the whole. The sugar generated by the trees nourishes the fungi through photosynthesis, and the beautiful dance of life goes on. So this beautiful dance of life at its deep root and trunk and branches and leaves is about exchange.
And yet, on Wall Street, we use the language of extract value without thinking there's anything wrong with it. That is what we do. How did, you know, we would ask the question, well, how are you going to extract value in that transaction? That's like the whole point, is to extract value. That's where, in a sense, extra profit comes from, is through extracting value. And I say that with no judgment, because we didn't know we were doing something wrong. This has nothing to do with the cheating, the bad ethics, all that stuff. That's another layer on top. But this is just like, if everyone was a Boy Scout on Wall Street, we would be doing everything in conflict with how life works.
You know, I want to add something to what you read, Fay, and what we're talking about. And this was, I'm pulling this out of an older interview that we did with the late Australian Bill Mollison, who was recognized as a co-founder of permaculture. And this is what he once said about trees in a New Dimensions interview. I'm going to read this. He says, "I think trees are great translators standing between earth and the air. They take in light, produce sugar, and then share that sugar with bacteria and fungi," as you just spoke about, Faye. "The roots draw minerals upward, fueling a vast underground network. It's hard to believe all that is happening. Then when the tree drops its leaves, within just 4 days, they're transformed into rich black soil, a profound gift of nourishment for the earth. The trees are all in constant communication. If one is damaged and a beetle comes to lay eggs, it sends out a distress signal unique to its species. All are living in relation to one another." And he concludes by saying this: "This is an outstanding example of the true nature of abundance. The tree is a natural attractor of well-being. I'm constantly standing in the vibrational field of divine prosperity, where the activity of divine abundance is eternally operating." And I just felt like that was such an elegant view of this living system that we know. We all know trees, and you are taking this and really illustrating how our economies, which are the greatest participation. I mean, we're all participating in economy. We're buying, we're selling, all each of us as individuals. So this is a profound view of why economies are a living system, because they're interconnected networks. Any comment on that?
Well, for me, it's the beautiful simplicity that the shift we are undergoing and the shift that we can serve is by learning to see from the whole to the part. We're so used to seeing from the part to the whole. And we now know for sure that everything is interconnected, yet we're still creating things as if we're separate. So we need to learn to see from wholeness and to see wholeness. And we can even practice looking at trees. We still see them maybe as separate from each other or separate from us, but they're not. A forest is a living entity, as you've spoken to. So we are in a polycrisis on the planet, and yet at the very same time that we don't want to get where we're headed, we're also this new scientific understanding, which meets our spiritual understanding, is coming just when we need it. I take great hope from that.
Let's talk about the scalability of how we can participate in this new view. What does it look like to actually manifest now on the idea of a new era of economic regenerative economics? How do we participate in that?
So maybe I'll jump in and use a very concrete example from the beautiful symbiotic relationship of trees that we've been talking about. And again, the principle, and again, my language is just one person's language who comes from one particular context. There's lots of ways to talk about these same ideas. But if this notion of right relationship or symbiosis is a first principle that we can see everywhere we look, if we look carefully, which I think it is. I don't think any scientist who understands living systems would at all. It'd be like the first thing that they would say is that it's fundamentally relational. Then let's think about, Let's think about how the way our financial system works. I think all of your listeners would agree, just from intuition, that the financial markets have become a speculative casino, much more so in the last 20 years than when I was in the business. But when I was in the business, I was part of building the capital markets. And we saw that as only a good thing. Liquid financial markets, Jamie Dimon has called it one of America's greatest strengths. But that's looking at it through the lens of a financier built in a machine age logic. If I look at it through this living systems lens, speculation, and I could, you know, there's layers of this. I can make the case why some speculation is good. But think about what speculation is. It's you know, Faye and I are going to speculate on the price of IBM stock. And I think it's going to go up, and she thinks it's going to go down. So I buy it, and she sells it to me. And we're both speculating. And only one of us can be right. Either it's going to go up or it's going to go down, and one of us wins and one of us loses. And if I happen to have some special inside information about it, then I'm extracting from Faye because I have some insight that she doesn't have. Now, if I tell you that 99% of the trading in the capital markets is now speculation, and it's a proposition, it's a win-lose proposition, it doesn't take a PhD in economics to understand that there's probably something that is not in right relationship there, right? But we don't see speculation as in conflict with the first principle of living systems. We see it as a natural thing that finance does. But imagine if we lived in a world where that speculation was curtailed radically, so that when investment capital flowed, it didn't flow into speculative activity, it flowed into the real economy. So, for example, let's say it invested in the transition of the energy system from fossil fuels to renewable energies. There can be a right relationship. The investor can find a good project. The project, developer can develop a good project. Everyone can, quote, win, and the outcome can be beneficial qualitatively for the health of the planet and the health of the economy. So that's also an investment, but it's not a speculative investment. It's a real investment. If we are serious about following these first principles, our regulatory framework would guide the flow of investment capital, the lifeblood of an economy, into such activities and away from this excess speculation.
Well, I'm thinking, John, if we were investing, rather than investing in efficiency or something like that, this is a very efficient way of dealing with the world, or this is an efficient product, to shift that thinking to, okay, what can I invest in that would make my community more resilient? Mm-hmm. So it's talking about efficiency versus resilience. And I know
you're drawing on Bernard Lyotard again.
Oh, tell me.
So this is fascinating, and Faye will jump in on this. But when I met Bernard, I had a science teacher named Sally Gorner early in my work at Capital Institute. And she's a legitimate scientist, and she had co-authored a book with Bernard. And she introduced to Bernard this work from another scientist named Bob Ulanowitz. And Bob has developed what he calls a window of vitality. And from the actual study of living systems, he learned that living systems balance efficiency and resiliency. And so it blew my mind, because economics optimizes efficiency, just as you were saying. There's a beautiful little diagram that shows this window of vitality that is balanced, another principle, you know, dynamic balance. It's balanced it between resiliency and efficiency, but it skews toward resiliency. So we have an economics that's all about the pursuit of efficiency. Like that's the understood goal and skewed toward resiliency. And in fact, the more volatile the world gets, the more that skew toward resiliency will move toward resiliency, because the more volatile, the more resiliency matters. So we're right at this polycrisis where we should be radically shifting our systems toward resiliency, but our economics is still maximizing for efficiency. It, you know, Einstein once said, theory determines what you're able to see. So, you know, the world's on fire and people wonder why John Fullerton's spending all this time talking about theory. But theory determines what we're able to see. And so we talk about climate change as if it's a market failure, because all we know is markets. Well, it's not a market failure. It's a design feature. We've designed the system to create climate change. But we don't see it because our theory doesn't qualitatively distinguish between growth that is polluting us and growth that is not polluting us.
What you're talking about is a whole new way of making things and how we look at what we are inventing and how we reuse it in so many ways. I mean, I think that that's what we're talking about. And going back to the GDP, I mean, the GDP includes all the people who are sick, and they, and if they're going to hospitals and paying for health care.
That's good for GDP. Yeah.
And that's part of the GDP, saying, oh, we're doing so well, but it's not saying how sick we are, you know.
Well, you were drawing on your prior guest, Bill McDonough's work, you know, on this idea of circular or cradle to cradle. That's an important piece, you know, in the principles that I talk about. I talk about robust circulation. So think about a metabolism of a living organism. A living organism metabolizes by having healthy inputs. So in an economy, if the inputs are fossil fuel-based chemicals, those chemicals don't go anywhere. They stay in the system, and everything's connected to everything. So ultimately, they poison the system, including us. So we can't fix the problem until we get the toxins out of the system. Just like you can't be healthy if you're eating crappy food. But we don't think of it as a metabolism. We just think of the problem, which is now chemical pollution in the ocean. But the problem is we have an unhealthy metabolism. That's climate change is essentially a symptom of an unhealthy metabolism. It's not a problem to solve. It's a design flaw.
A design flaw. Okay, so if it's a design flaw, what is our participation in resolving this design flaw that we have created?
Faye, do you want to tackle that one?
I'm going to go for participation, because I think waking up to how our participation matters is so much a part of this. And our design flaw has created a crisis, and somehow there's intrinsic in crisis is opportunity. And I think the crisis is bringing us to a waking up. What's happening isn't working. As Lao Tzu said, if you don't change direction, you might get where we're going. Well, we don't want to get where we're going. And so we want to wake up. You know, the book ends on a quotation from Teilhard de Chardin that the most telling and profound way of describing the evolution of the universe would undoubtedly be to trace the evolution of love. And to speak to love in the context of economics may seem so strange, except that when we allow our motions within this living system called the economy to rise from what we love and truly care about, our motions will be different. They will be much more in the spirit of exchange than extraction. We're going to see the whole picture different.
Exactly. You know, one thing that I got from the book, I mean, there were a lot of different concepts, and you have the eight principles of regenerative economics within the book. But one of the things that I got that you point out is honoring the community and place. And when you talk about place, we often think about, oh, our geography. Okay, I'm in Northern California, and you know, at this latitude and longitude, and here, you know, all it becomes a physical place. But you also add that human culture is also intricately involved in place. So that's where that goes back to that living systems. My place is not just a geological place or a house or an apartment someplace. It's also all the relationships and networks that are going on around me and with me.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'd invite your listeners to explore the work in particular of the Regenesis Group. They do beautiful work around place. They have an expression, the essence of place. And so rather than, you know, a lot of people talk about something being place-based, but they talk about things being place-sourced. And so the idea is that a place is where geological reality and human culture intersect and co-create together. So the essence of Northern California is partly the geological reality of it, but it's also partly the history of the human settlements there, going way back to the very beginning of the human settlements, which is very different than the history of human settlements where I live. And the geology is very different here. And so naturally, these are going to be different places. And so naturally, the economy here should look different than the economy there. But here's the cool thing. Just like, and Faye's heard me say this 15 times at least, you know, every snowflake is unique, but every snowflake looks like a snowflake. So the idea of these first principles, eight principles, is that they show up everywhere in a healthy living organism and in a healthy economy. But they will look very unique and different in the unique context of different places. And so again, contrast that with how we've set up the global economy, which is essentially about scaling monocultures for efficiency across the entire planet. So contrast, you know, I'll pick on Walmart. Walmart is like the gorilla of a monoculture, a sameness. Every single store has the same layout, the same business model, the same supply chain, and it's done it at incredible scale and efficiency, but it's in direct conflict with the principle of honor community in place, because it's essentially destroyed the essence of place for the sake of efficiency everywhere it goes. And again, I'm not picking on Walmart. They've executed a business plan the way we were all taught to execute a business plan.
Exactly. I love it. I'm so glad you brought that up, because it just reminds us of really holding on to the uniqueness of our place and the history of it and the culture of it. And I'm so sorry. I mean, we're going to have to end this conversation. I know we could just go on and on and on. You both are so articulate on this whole subject of regenerative economics. I'm so glad to have you on. So I want to remind our listeners that I've been speaking with John Fullerton and Faye Cox, who have collaborated with the First Hour Books publication, Regenerative Economics, Creating Conditions for Health and Abundance on a Living Planet. And this book includes all the eight principles of regenerative economics. So you'll want to pick it up. Or to sponsor the book or to receive a copy, go to the website ourbooks.com. That's H-O-U-R, ourbooks.com. And for John, if you want to know more about his work, he is also the author of Regenerative Economics, Revolutionary Thinking for a World in Crisis. Go to capitalinstitute.org. That's his nonprofit organization. I'm Justine Willis-Toms, and I want to thank you for listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3851.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain.
This is Bird Note. In the depths of winter, when sub-zero temperatures last for months and most lakes and ponds are frozen over, how do birds stay hydrated? Water derived from food alone is not enough, especially since juicy insects are in short supply this time of the year. Instead of flying long distances and losing precious energy in search of liquid water, birds imbibe the frozen water that's all around them, while cedar waxwings sally to catch snowflakes from midair. Plenty of other birds, including the red-breasted nuthatch, white-tailed ptarmigan, pileated woodpecker, and Bohemian waxwing, scoop up fresh, powdery snow from the ground, trees, or rooftops. Black-capped chickadees drink the water dripping from icicles. The northern flicker hammers at the icy top layer of snow and eats the tiny shards of ice that chip off. Eating all that ice comes at a cost. It takes energy to convert ice and snow to water and warm it up to the body temperature of a bird. But it may be worth the calories for, say, a red-breasted nuthatch, when the alternative is to break off from the flock in search of liquid water, leaving it exposed to predators such as hawks. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Do you like music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
CJSF 90.1 FM wishes you a bright winter solstice.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcasts.